Good evening. I'm Terry Wang in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. The Koreas trade harmless volleys as tensions continue to mount. China's president makes an historic visit to the European Union. And Taiwanese protesters express their outrage at the way their leaders make deals with the mainland. Those stories and more in the next half hour on VOA's Crossroads Asia. The two Koreas traded hundreds of rounds of live artillery fire across their disputed maritime border today. The exchange, triggered by a three-hour North Korean live fire exercise that dropped around 100 shells into South Korean waters. South Korea's defense ministry said it had responded by firing 300 shells from batteries based on its frontline islands. North-South tensions have been rising for weeks. The North is angered by the annual South Korean U.S. military drills, which it calls a rehearsal for invasion. The allies say that they are just routine and defensive in nature. On Sunday, Pyongyang threatened to conduct a fourth nuclear test, though Seoul said it sees no signs it's imminent. Commentary in China state-run media today urged people to react rationally to the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 after days of protest by passengers' relatives who say Malaysia has mishandled the investigation. Many Chinese kin of passengers have expressed extreme skepticism over the accounts by the Malaysian government, maintaining that it's not telling all that it knows about the plane's disappearance March 8th, and expressing frustration that it concluded the jet went down in the Indian Ocean without any physical evidence. Several dozen of the relatives traveled to Malaysia on Sunday and staged a protest after arriving. The International Court of Justice says that Japan's Antarctic whaling program is not for scientific purposes. It has ordered a temporary stay on the program. Australia had sued Japan at the UN Disputed Resolution Court for resolving its hopes in ending whaling in the icy Southern Ocean. More than 100,000 people packed the streets outside of Taiwan's presidential office on Sunday to call for scrapping the trade agreement with China. But the mostly younger protesters were less worried about doing business with powerful political rival Beijing than they were fed up with the way that deals are being made at home. Ralph Jennings reports from VOA from Taipei on the new demands of Taiwan's spiraling protest movement.
Protesters estimated between 100,000 and 400,000 packed boulevards and metro stations in central Taipei Sunday, wearing black shirts as a symbol of what they call poor transparency. They demanded that their president scrap a pact with China to liberalize investment in each other's service sectors. Some demonstrators fear Beijing will leverage the pact to push self-rule Taiwan into uniting with China as a single country. China has seen Taiwan as its own since the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s. But most are angry that President Ma Ying-jeou's government signed the agreement in June without telling people more about it. Protester Mai Bo-jun, a 28-year-old night school student from northern Taiwan, does not understand what's in the agreement. He says he does not oppose the proposed trade pact, but that the problem is the government passed it before saying clearly what's inside. He says that has caused young people not to know what lies ahead in their future. He hopes the government can clearly tell the public about every element of the pact instead of just saying at news conferences that it's great. Sunday's protest follows from an occupation of parliament since March 18. Hundreds of students first blocked the podium to make legislators ratify the trade pact item by item rather than as a package. Now they want it thrown out and renegotiated. Previous protests in Taiwan against China tie-ups have focused on perceived political threats from Beijing. But 20 deals signed under President Ma to date have lifted Taiwan's trade, tourism, and investment for local business people while creating an estimated 9,600 local jobs. Officials say the agreement contested today will lift Taiwan's service sector, which is 69% of the economy. Taiwan's president has made an international name since 2008 for breaking 60 years of icy relations with China to reach the first economic, trade, and investment agreements between the two countries. Protesters now want more public review before agreements are signed, often in China, and after private meetings between the two sides' ruling parties. Taiwanese fretted again over the lack of a clear agenda when the two sides held first-ever ministerial-level talks in February. Many also criticized President Ma for responding too slowly or curtly to domestic problems. Lin Zhongbin, a retired strategic studies professor in Taiwan, says anger boiled over this month.
This is the result of accumulated frustration. China was the background. It's not really the major factor.
The ruling Nationalist Party faces growing pressure to concede something to students occupying parliament as local elections approach later this year. But Ma's government points to 20 public hearings on the services trade pact and a mechanism to ensure that deals with China do not hurt local enterprises. The president says he will stick by the agreement. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Census takers are fanning out across Burma, also known as Myanmar, to gather data for the first official count of the population in more than 30 years, but using what rights groups call a flawed form that threatens to inflame ethnic and religious tensions. The census form in question is the result of a collaboration between the Burmese government and the UN Population Fund. It includes questions about race and ethnicity that its rights groups warn put vulnerable populations at risk. The census, which began on Sunday and runs through April 12th, follows last week's attack on the offices of an international relief group in western Rakhine State by a Buddhist mob after an aid worker reportedly removed a Buddhist flag from in front of the office in what was perceived as an act of disrespect. Buddhists have placed flags in the village as part of a protest against the mainly Muslim Rohingya minority group. One girl was killed as security forces moved in to protect the aid workers who left the state capital Friday. A dusk-to-dawn curfew was imposed. Aid groups have been targeted for their assistance to the Rohingya minority, who now live in crowded camps where they have little access to food, education, jobs, or health care. The government denies the Rohingya many of their basic rights, including citizenship. It views them as illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. Buddhist Muslim violence erupted in Rakhine State in 2012 and has since spread to other parts of the country. The sectarian fighting has killed at least 240 people and displaced 140,000 others, mainly Rohingya Muslims who are called Bengali by the Burmese government. Ethnic minorities make up about 40% of the country's population. Groups such as the Kachin, who have not signed a ceasefire with the central government, have said that they were not consulted about the census and have threatened to boycott the process. Tin Mong Mong Thong, a senior resident fellow at the Singapore-based Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, told VOA's Victor Beattie the census is long overdue.
Apparently, previous governments probably didn't have the capacity as well as the security to do that. And the new government, which came to power in 2011, decided with the help of the UN and other friendly countries who will support technically and financially to start it. It has started several years back, actually, but it started into motion when this government came to power. Basically, you need baseline data for economic purposes and regional development. That's the stated purpose, which I believe from the point of view of national, you know, kind of development is valid. But of course, there are other repercussions, political and social too, which I think it was taken into consideration. But the overriding factor is this economic development kind of approach, socio-economic development.
You probably know that this census is surrounded in controversy, particularly with regard to the list of 135 official ethnicities. Was the timing good or bad for this census?
Ideally, you have to settle this 135 issues first. But the likelihood is that it will be a long, drawn-out kind of contentious issue. And so I think, technically speaking, they just built on the previous whatever data they have. And actually, this has went back a long way to the British, which is, of course, also one of the problems. Because it's an ethno-linguistic thing. It's not purely ethnic or even linguistic. So it's very complicated. So I think the government rationale is we count first and then settle it later with the ethnic groups and then say, okay, if it is wrong, what do you expect, blah, blah, blah. So that's their rationale. So that's why they started now, perhaps because the current regime also want to show during its five-year kind of tenure that they are moving forward in the economic development.
With regard to the Rohingya, the Muslims who have emigrated from Bangladesh, there has been a lot of controversy that that name will not be used. They'll be referred to as Bengali. There's some question whether or not they'll even take part.
Technically speaking, in the questionnaire, you have 135 ticks, right, on which ethnic subnational you belong. And there's one called others. So those who are foreigners will say, okay, others, which is Indian, Chinese, blah, blah. But in the case of this self, what they call Rohingyas, which the Myanmar government and the people didn't accept, technically they have to take at the others and then write down what they thought they were, right? So that's the option given to every other interviewee. But in the case, in that option, if they write down Rohingya, that was not to be accepted. That's what I understand. And that is the controversy. So it's not that the enumerator will force the guy to say, write down Bengali. They are not supposed to force people to write down. But it is a contradiction in a way, technically speaking, because if they write down what they want and what they believe, anything except Rohingya is acceptable. So this is really, really a very politicized issue. And if then the interviewee refused on that ground, they are liable to be persecuted under the law for the census, which was promulgated last year. So it creates another problem in the next step. What, are you going to persecute thousands of people? I don't know.
Sam Zarifi of the Bangkok-based International Commission of Justice says the plight of the Rohingya can only worsen.
One of the major problems over the last few years has been that while the promise of economic development is huge and Myanmar is potentially a very, very wealthy country, different ethnic groups seem to be getting potentially different cuts of that economic development. And at the very bottom of that are the Rohingya, who face really what can only be called absolutely brutal racism. They are legally stateless. They don't have proper legal status. Many of them can't own property. They can't attend school. They can't marry. So the discrimination against them is legally in place and enforced with strong possibility of violence, as we've seen in the last few years with attacks on them, and the government not really doing anything about it. So it's not just that the Rohingya will be left out of the economic development of the country, but that, in fact, their situation may get worse, as we have seen in the last few years with demands by chauvinist Buddhist groups for attacking them, literally kicking them out of the country and subjecting them to horrific violence.
We're not talking about relatively new immigrants. These folks have been around for quite some time in Myanmar.
There are a number of different Muslim groups in Myanmar, but the Rohingya are probably one of the largest. They themselves claim that they have lived in Arakan State in western Myanmar for hundreds of years. The Myanmar government, as well as many hardline Buddhist groups, claim that they are illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, and in fact, they demand that the Rohingya call themselves Bengali. So there is a question about kind of the status of these people. And unfortunately, over the last couple of years, we have seen Buddhist monks, very racist, very violent Buddhist monks, publicly demanding that the Rohingya be sent back, quote unquote, to Bangladesh. Of course, Bangladesh doesn't think that the Rohingya are Bengali, nor does it want them. And there are tens of thousands of Rohingya who live on refugee camps in terrible situations on the Bangladesh border. So the issue is that under Myanmar law, the Rohingya are not recognized as a separate ethnicity. And therefore, they have very few rights, legally speaking. And this, of course, is the kind of discrimination that goes directly against the international human rights mechanism. The notion that an entire group of people can be discriminated against just on the basis of their ethnicity is an absolute violation of human rights. And the problem is that under Myanmar law, this is the law. And unfortunately, neither the government nor the opposition parties have really spoken up in favor of the Rohingya. And so, if anything, we've seen them subjected to more violence in the last year or so than we had in the previous few years.
Human Rights Watch called for a postponement of the census and elimination of the more sensitive questions about ethnicity and religion to prevent growing communal violence and attacks on the aid community. The results of the census are expected to be released in three stages ahead of the national election set for 2015. A Pakistani court today indicted former military ruler Pervez Musharraf for treason, a milestone for civilian authority in a country long dominated by the army. The charge carries the maximum penalty of death, but observers are uncertain whether authorities will allow the trial to be completed and risk angering the powerful military which has ruled Pakistan for half its history. Musharraf had missed most of the trial's hearings due to ill health and security threats, but he appeared fit and confident after arriving today in a long convoy of SUVs. The ex-general, who seized power in 1999 and resigned in 2008, pleaded not guilty to one of the judges hearing the case since December as he read the charges relating to his 2007 imposition of emergency rule. Musharraf declared a state of emergency in November 2007, suspending the Constitution shortly before the Supreme Court was due to rule on the legality of his re-election as president a month earlier. He then arrested and sacked the country's top judges, including the Chief Justice, who challenged his decision. Next year's anticipated departure of foreign troops from Afghanistan is focusing new attention on Pakistan's volatile border region known as the Federally Administered Tribal Areas, or FATA. The region has long been outside state control, and observers worry it could become an epicenter of international terrorism if the militant groups based there are left unchecked after foreign troops leave Afghanistan. Ayuz Gol has a report from Islamabad.
With a population of around 5 million, the semi-autonomous Fatah region of Pakistan mostly consists of seven tribal districts, all but one border Afghanistan. The lawless territory has long been a refuge for fugitives and criminal gangs involved in kidnapping, trafficking drugs and weapons. In the 1980s, it served as a training ground for radicalized Afghan and Arab fighters who participated in the U.S.-funded insurgency against the Soviet occupation. That fundamentally changed the region, says author Ahmed Rashid.
In the 1980s, Fatah was a huge dumping ground for weapons and ammunition for the Mujahideen. Both by the CIA and the ISI, thousands of miles of road were built right up to the Afghan border so that these arms and ammunition could be dumped right on the border and then mule packs could take them further into the country to fight the Soviets.
In the years that followed the Soviet withdrawal in 1989, critics say Pakistan's spy agency continued to assist groups based in the region to exert influence in Afghanistan. Rashid says the region remains a key base for the Afghan insurgency to this day.
In 2003-2004, the Afghan Taliban were relaunched in Afghanistan with the help of Pakistan. Fatah played a huge role in that relaunching. A great many of the Afghan Taliban were based in Fatah.
The United States and Afghanistan have long said Fatah is used by militants for deadly cross-border raids on U.S. and coalition troops in Afghanistan. Pakistan's army has launched offensives over the years against some groups in parts of the tribal region, but it has not carried out a broad offensive sought by Afghanistan and the United States. Instead, Washington has targeted militants in the region through drone strikes, a policy that has created deep resentment in much of Pakistan. Pakistani authorities admit that the region harbors militants who have carried out attacks killing thousands in Pakistan. But Abdul Qadir Baloch, Federal Minister for States and Frontier Regions, says there are steep challenges to bringing the region under state control.
There have been large-scale migrations and displacements. There has been a massive radicalization of the society. Large-scale target killings have been taking place. The writ of the government has been weakened beyond almost repair, and there have been military operations also. The result of all this has been the disruption of the existing social fabric of Fatah.
Successive governments in Pakistan have often preferred to keep the status quo in Fatah instead of taking a chance on uncertain military or political strategies that face steep challenges for success. Yusuf Rahim, Fatah's additional director general projects, says there are still long-standing economic and social problems in Fatah that will make any intervention difficult.
60% of the population in Fatah is below the poverty line, which makes it pretty difficult to intervene in Fatah. The economic activity which we have in Fatah at the moment is I would say, negligible, and that primarily gives rise to unemployment and issues affiliated with that. We have a low literacy rate, around 17%.
Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has repeatedly described the militancy originating from Fatah as a threat to Pakistan. His administration is reaching out to the Taliban with peace talks, but it also has not ruled out a broader military offensive. American scholar Marvin Weinbaum says terrorists operating in Fatah pose threats to Pakistan's nuclear arsenal, making them a global danger.
The international community is sincerely concerned about, for one thing, Pakistan as a custodian of its nuclear assets, and that to the extent that terrorism is enabled in Pakistan, that it will make the nuclear assets vulnerable to extremist groups.
Pakistani officials insist the nuclear weapons are secure from militants. But Weinbaum argues that the departure of international forces in Afghanistan removes a powerful check on the militant groups in the region, making them a deadlier threat. The country's ruling political parties are making new efforts to reassert control over Fatah, possibly by changing the British colonial laws that still govern the region. Surveys indicate a majority of people favor making it a province like the rest of Pakistan, which could lead to the creation of police forces and courts to adjudicate disputes. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Taliban gunmen abducted a candidate running for a seat in the provincial council in northern Afghanistan today, along with seven members of his entourage. Also in the northern Sari-Upol province today, officials said a roadside bomb killed four Afghan policemen and wounded three. The violence is the latest in the lead-up to Saturday's balloting, when Afghanistan chooses a new president to replace Hamid Karzai and also elect members for its provincial councils. The Taliban have vowed to use force to disrupt the April 5th vote. Reports from Cambodia say police beat anti-government demonstrators who tried to defy a ban on public demonstrations to demand a license for what would be the Southeast Asian nation's first opposition television channel. Several hundred supporters of Mam Sonando, a fierce government critic, came out to protest. At least two people were injured in the clash, while several more were punched and kicked by security forces. Prime Minister Hun Sen's government has refused to issue a television license to Mam Sonando, saying there is no frequency available. All existing stations are closely linked to Hun Sen, who has been in power for decades. Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat testified today in front of an anti-graft official group over negligence charges that could lead to her removal from office and a ban from politics. Yingluck arrived at the National Anti-Corruption Commission in Bangkok, but made no comment to the media as she entered the building. She was summoned to answer charges linked to a controversial rice subsidy scheme, which paid farmers above market rates for their crops. And Chinese President Xi Jinping began a groundbreaking European visit today. He is the first Chinese leader to visit the headquarters of the 28-country EU in Brussels. The European Union is China's largest trading partner, while China is Europe's second largest, trailing only the United States. China's human rights record, a constant concern in the 28-nation bloc, is expected to be raised as protesters mass outside the EU institutions to demand freedom for jailed activists and more rights for Tibetans and other minorities. Tomorrow, Xi will visit the largest Chinese-owned company in Belgium, carmaker Volvo, in Ghent. Belgium will be hoping for new investments, though nothing on the scale of the mega deal signed earlier with Germany and France. Well, that'll wrap up our program today. Thank you for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Terry Wing. Just a reminder that you can always follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki coming up next.